Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and now that the CMJ Festival has ended here in New York, we have a moment to check in on the concert we co-presented with the CBGB Festival. That's the one that took place the week before CMJ. We'll bring you some live music from the veteran rock band The Meat Puppets, recorded at Brooklyn Bowl. And almost 50 years ago, they were rocking the shtetls on Broadway. We'll look at the cultural phenomenon that is Fiddler on the Roof. But first, Thomas Dolby. You know his hit songs, She Blinded Me with Science, Hyperactive, and the rest. But did you know that Thomas Dolby is also an international man of mystery?
It's been confirmed that a lighthouse in Suffolk, which is under threat from the sea, will be closed. It's thought it could collapse within a few years.
My name's Thomas Dolby. I'm trying to find out a date when the Orford Lighthouse is going to close.
I'm afraid that information is classified.
Because I'd really like to be there to film it, if that's at all possible.
No, that's really far too dangerous.
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Okay.
Look, you can't just go wandering around out there all on your own. The place is littered with unexploded warheads for a start. Mr. Dolby.
Oh, that's not going to end well. Or will it? Because actually, Thomas Dolby is here, seemingly intact, and bringing a film and music project called The Invisible Lighthouse, the result of his potentially dangerous and probably illegal attempt to document the closing of his local lighthouse. Thomas lives on a retrofitted lifeboat on the east coast of England. Thomas, good to see you in one piece and out of jail.
Thanks, John. It's nice to be back.
What was the lure of this lighthouse that you grew up near?
You know, I've seen it flashing on my bedroom wall since I can remember. And when I moved back from the USA to England about 6 years ago with my family, part of the reason was that I wanted my kids to experience what I'd experienced when I was young. And so some things change, as they do, and there's progress and there's erosion. But one of the most notable things was that I found out this lighthouse, the Orford Lighthouse, was going to be closed and decommissioned this year. And this made me very sad. It's going to fall into the North Sea sooner or later, like the 11 lighthouses before it that have been recorded on that point. But the fact that they were switching it off and I would no longer see that flash and nor would my kids was very evocative for me.
So you decided to document the end of this lighthouse and with it, I guess, the end of an era.
Well, yeah. I mean, the lighthouse was sort of iconic for me and was really a symbol of the coast where I grew up, which had so much to do with my music, with my songwriting. I don't write pop songs about text message breakups and sort of things like that. I tend to write about the weather, about geography, about atmospheric conditions, about parallel universes, about what if. And all of this, a lot of it I put down to, you know, where I grew up, which is this fantastic piece of coast. It's not rolling green hills and thatched cottages. It's not what you would expect. But it is the coast that has faced repeated failed invasions by, you know, Napoleon and the Nazis and the Vikings and so on. And you see the remnants of the sea defenses crumbling into the beach. So it's a very atmospheric place.
And so what were the roadblocks? Why couldn't you just, you know, go over to the island and film to your heart's content?
Well, Orford Ness, which is kind of an island, it is actually linked, but by a very narrow strip of shingle beach, is considered an island and was formerly owned by the Ministry of Defence because for most of the 20th century, they did experimental weapons testing there. For example, the first parachute jump ever done anywhere was done on Orford Ness. And they had all sorts of strange things like a death ray that could stop an aircraft engine at a distance of 5 miles. And then during the Cold War, they were testing detonators for military warheads. They claimed that there were no nukes there. But there are these strange pagodas out on the island with these roofs designed to collapse in the event a device went off by mistake. So they don't like people wandering around out there. And it's now controlled by the National Trust because it has many specimens of unique plants that grow there. So you're allowed to do tours, but you have to stay on the road and you have to follow a docent around. And I needed to wander out there and capture the last flash of the lighthouse from all different angles on the island. So when I got no cooperation from the authorities, I sort of decided to take the law into my own hands.
And what form did that take?
Well, I mounted a clandestine commando raid at dawn on the island with spy cameras rolling. So I got a little inflatable rib, high-speed rib, and I plotted...
That's a rigid inflatable boat.
Yeah. And I plotted this one particular cove I could pull into on the island, which would be out of line of sight of the docents. And I had a narrow window of tide when I can get in there. And I had these cool GoPro cameras that sort of surfers and skateboarders use that have all sorts of, you know, waterproof enclosures and things. And I had a quadricopter camera, you know, like a little helicopter thing that you fly from your iPhone, that was following me around. And I walked off across Orford Ness with these cameras rolling. And I thought, well, if I bump into an unexploded ordnance, then at least it's going to provide a suitable climax for the film. But here I am in one piece.
Wow. I mean, it sounds like you had everything except the cane that turns into a machine gun. Or a very, very James Bond, this experience.
Well, yes, although to do it with a James Bond-style crew and budget would not have been feasible. They would have just said no.
Right.
But the fact is that the equipment for video has gotten cheap and affordable and really good. And this is revolutionizing filmmaking. You know, you can now do stuff on your own and you can wander around, you know, around the streets looking like a tourist, you know, with a little camera on a tripod. And this is fantastic. And it's parallel to what happened 20, 25 years earlier with music, mm-hmm. where suddenly instead of, you know, needing a label and a record company, a budget, you could go make a record in your back room and distribute it over the internet. And it produced fantastic changes in music and leveled the playing field. And I think the same thing is starting to happen with video and filmmaking.
Well, one of the results is Thomas Dolby's new live music and film project called The Invisible Lighthouse. Let's hear a little bit.
It's not the picture postcard England of thatched cottages and Buckingham Palace. But this place is in my bones. And it seeped into my chord changes and lyrics. And these secret locations became the backdrop for my photo and video shoots. I was 14, she was 12. Father traveled, hers as well. Europa. Down on beaches, hand in hand, 12 and never on the sand, then war took her away. We swore a vow that day.
Thomas Dolby and The Invisible Lighthouse, a music and film experience which Thomas is bringing here to New York on October 28th at the Gramercy Theater. And for our listeners in Detroit, November 3rd at the Royal Oak Music Theater in Royal Oak, Michigan. So you made the film, and as we've already heard, it sort of leads you into songs both old and new from your catalog. Did you always know that the sea had this kind of impact, or was this something you kind of realized later in your career?
I think I realized going back and creating the soundtrack for the film that many of my songs from the beginning had this very strong influence of the sea and of the countryside where I grew up. My ancestors are from around there. You can see old buildings that were built by my great-grandfather that are still there, that are, some of them crumbling, some of them still around. And, you know, I'm aware that this is also a legacy that I'm sort of passing on to my kids with a few changes. The lighthouse will be gone, but there is Europe's largest wind farm being built offshore just on the horizon. You can just occasionally see it when the sun is glinting on the blades. And, you know, I wrote a song called Wind Power back in 1980, so it's great to see this sort of coming to fruition. And I sit in my lifeboat watching the strange vehicles taking these turbines out to the North Sea, going in and out. I've become a bit of a train spotter.
Thomas Dolby with us on Soundcheck, talking about his project called The Invisible Lighthouse. How do you refer to this? Is it a documentary? It's almost more like an intervention, it seems.
Well, it is, really. It's sort of, well, it's a docu-tour, really, because I decided not to release the film commercially, at least for now. The only way to experience the film is to come and see it when I perform it live. And when I project it, and I do the narration and the instrumental score and the songs and even the Foley sound effects are live on stage in the theatre. And so I think it makes for a very unique experience.
So Blake Lee, is it, who's your Foley artist?
Blake Lay, yeah.
Lay.
He's a world-class sound designer. I mean, he's credited with sound design on things like The Abyss and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. He was the music supervisor on The Wire and Tremé. This is like a world-class talent, and he's sort of slumming it with me out in the road, but he does live Foley, so he has a pit of stones and twigs and leaves. He does the flapping of bird wings. He does the sound of the surf. You may have seen in you know, behind the scenes Hollywood films where there's a guy in front of the screen doing all of the sounds live. Well, he's doing that live on stage and playing a bit of guitar as well.
Right. Plays on Europa, for example, which we heard before. Going back to an earlier song of yours, Cloudburst at Shingle Street is one of this about half a dozen or so of your songs that are sort of woven into the fabric of this piece. How does this song come into play?
Well, Shingle Street is a tiny village on the coast where there was supposedly a repelled invasion in 1942. It had been evacuated because of the risk of invasion. And you have to remember that people at that time, they didn't know how long the war was going to last. The rest of Europe had fallen. You were almost close enough to the European mainland to see the panzer tanks lining up, you know, getting ready to invade. So people just assumed the Nazis were going to invade at any moment. And my granny lived there and used to poison half the food in her larder because she was so convinced the Germans were going to invade. So if you were a visitor...
So you had to be careful when you raided the pantry at grandma's house.
You had to memorize which food was safe to eat, yeah. So this was the way that they lived. And I found out about this, but when I went and walked this beach... And there was this fantastic storm while I was there. I got completely drenched. But it really seemed like I was sort of immersing myself. It's this sort of baptismal experience, you know, to be walking this beach and getting drenched. And that resulted in the song Cloudburst at Shingle Street.
From my guest Thomas Dolby on Soundcheck. Some of Cloudburst at Shingle Street from Thomas Dolby, who's with me on Soundcheck, as he does occasionally when there's new work involved, and the new work this time is called The Invisible Lighthouse, a film documenting the end, the decommissioning, the Orford Lighthouse near your home on England's eastern coast, facing the North Sea. So you mentioned before, you know, you've written so many songs about weather and natural elements and the sea and lifeboats and submarines and all this kind of stuff. Was that intentional, or, you know, do you just kind of look back at that and say, wow, I've done a heck of a lot of that sort of thing?
I've always been a bit contrary, you know. It's like when I started out, this is, you know, late 70s, early 80s, and it was the new wave. There were a lot of sort of you know, pin-up poster children that, you're Sting and you're Simon Le Bon and Adam Ant and so on. And I came from this very academic background. You know, my father was a professor of classical archaeology at Oxford. Many teachers in my family. I went to a private boarding school. I wasn't going to fit into this sort of mainstream pop thing, you know. So I kind of went the other way deliberately, and I avoided singing songs that are sort of in the moment about relationships and things, and tended to be a little bit more sort of geographical about the songs that I wrote. And that's just always been my way of doing things. But there's a sort of surreal aspect to my work also. It's sort of what if, you know, what if the microchip had never been invented and we had to run everything on cogs and clockwork and steam, you know? What if the Germans had invaded? How would things have turned out? You know, so often there's this sort of parallel universe to what I do. Mm-hmm. And in that situation, I always sort of cast myself as the dissident underground rebel, you know, with the ham radio set.
The guy who would take a rigid inflatable boat and make a pre-dawn raid on an island with spy cameras just because he wants to get his picture.
Precisely.
So how did the film turn out? I mean, is it kind of a panoramic view of the lighthouse? Is there more to it? Are there shots of the coast?
Well, the lighthouse links together multiple threads. There are stories about my predecessors, about how they came to be there. I mean, Britain was originally attached to Europe. You know, there was no North Sea thousands or millions of years ago. So my ancestors may have actually walked from Holland, you know, but it's steadily sinking and the British Isles are tipping and our coast is doomed. So there's a lot of different sort of aspects of that. Interesting stories as well. For example, one about a potential UFO encounter at Rendlesham Forest in 1980. This is viewed as Britain's
Sector 51?
Yeah, exactly. And three U.S. servicemen...
Area 51, sorry.
Yeah. Three U.S. servicemen believed they had an encounter with a UFO in the woods.
So wait, even in the U.K., it's Americans who are seeing the UFOs?
Funny that, isn't it? Funny that happens. Yeah. But among the debunking theories for this, as there always are, one is that they got spooked out. They came to a gap in the woods where you could see the flash of the lighthouse. And I retraced their steps and I went out there and I was a bit underwhelmed because the flash at that point was just this sort of puny thing and there's no way anybody could have mistaken that for a flying saucer. And I thought back to the fact that I remembered this epic sweeping beam of the lighthouse when I was a kid and I wondered if I was dreaming, because there was another story when I saw the roof of a building burn. This is a building that my great-great-grandfather built at Snake Maltings, which is used for the Aldborough Festival.
Right.
The roof burned when I was 10, and I remember watching it at night in terror across the marshes. And years later, my mum told me, look, I hate to tell you, we were never actually there. We were miles away that night. So this memory was an implanted memory which has sort of become burned onto my retina.
Wow.
And I started questioning memory. And I wondered whether, in fact, these guys, as they've gone to UFO conventions and been interviewed by the Sci-Fi Channel and so on, whether they've sort of, you know, in their brains, it's become a bit scrambled, you know. And that is the nature of memory, is that you know, it becomes amplified and distorted over time. And again, this sort of became the undercurrent, really, for my film.
In dreams, the sky are azure blue, the sea's a mirror pond. Then you wake to howling wind and rain upon your roof tiles. It won't be long, it won't be very long. The superstitious sailors of old refuse to learn to swim, but there's no need to drown these days, 'cause we've got lifeboats. Where are the lifeboats? There are.
The film is called The Invisible Lighthouse, with live narration, live sound effects, and live music from Thomas Dolby. And as you tour around here in the States with this story of the Orford Lighthouse near your childhood home. You're trying to raise awareness for the various lighthouses that we have here in the States.
Well, it was really too late for me to do anything about the Orford Lighthouse because the sea has encroached almost to the foundations now, so it's going to crumble, and they had to get the mercury out and so on. But it turns out that around the U.S. coast and on its rivers, there are many endangered lighthouses that no longer serve as much of a navigational function because, you know, your smartphone has probably got better navigation on it at this point than these lighthouses. So all around America's coast and on the rivers, there are lighthouses that are at threat either from erosion or from vandalism. And there is a doomsday list of 46 of them. And since this doomsday list has been published, there have been some success stories, such as the Cape Hatteras,
Cape Hatteras.
Yeah, lighthouse, which has been successfully brought back. But there's also very many that are seriously at risk. The Cedar Island Lighthouse out in Sag Harbor, for example, is a very famous one. And they are under the domain of the Coast Guard, but they are nothing but a drain on the Coast Guard's budget. So it's really up to the private sector to try and do something about them. Some of them have passed into private ownership and are being set up as B&Bs. Some of them are too remote for that to happen. They're on islands and so on. But it's a big piece of America's heritage, and I think that we need to pay some attention to saving them.
And it is such a romantic, or to use a word you used earlier, evocative and atmospheric part of living near water.
It's amazing how many people have a pet lighthouse from their childhood, and they're going to miss them when they're gone.
The Invisible Lighthouse is Thomas Dolby's project, film and music and live narration and sound. New York at the Gramercy Theater on October 28th. And for our WDET listeners, November 3rd at Royal Oak Music Theater in Royal Oak, Michigan. Thomas Dolby, always something interesting every time you join us on Soundcheck. Thanks very much.
Nice to be here.
This piece, called Oceania, is part of Thomas Dolby's last music project, which was also a video game, and he made it on his lifeboat/studio in or on the North Sea coast, so it is directly related to the Invisible Lighthouse project we've been talking about. Let's hear a bit of it.
A nightingale sang above my mother's tomb. Twilight in the afternoon. I stumble home to crocuses are still in bloom. I stumble home to Oceania.
little bit of music from Thomas Dolby. That is Oceania, which is the title track from one of three parts of his album and video game called A Map of the Floating City. Thomas Dolby's latest project includes this song. That is his film and music piece called The Invisible Lighthouse. Coming up next, we hear the story of how Fiddler on the Roof made it to Broadway almost a half century ago, and why, even if you never saw the musical or the movie, you probably know a bunch of the songs. Plus, we'll hear some live audio of the band The Meat Puppets, taken from our recent CBGB Festival show at Brooklyn Bowl. Stay with us. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. It's been almost 50 years since the musical Fiddler on the Roof made its Broadway debut, but the story of Tevye and his three marriageable daughters started long before that, and its influence has continued long after. Joining me here in the studio is Alisa Solomon, Columbia University journalism professor and author of the new book, Wonder of Wonders, A Cultural History of Fiddler on the Roof. Alisa, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks very much.
So you write in the book that this show about tradition has become tradition.
Absolutely. It's been embraced certainly by Jewish audience members who recognized aspects of their own culture in it, but has been loved and admired and taken to the hearts of people of all kinds of cultural backgrounds.
And some of those songs have become, they're like, we know who wrote them. You know, we can ascribe lyrics and music to easily identifiable human beings, but they're like folk songs. They're just in the ether at this point.
Yeah, I mean, Sunrise Sunset is still a staple at weddings. If you go on any of those websites looking for wedding songs, the father-daughter song, it's always in that list. The Sabbath prayer song is sung at summer camps, in Jewish summer camps, where kids are singing that instead of the actual prayer.
Right. So it kind of reminds me a little bit of Edelweiss from mm-hmm. Sound of Music, you know, where people think that's like an actual signifier of Austria and the Alps and stuff. Again, Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Exactly.
So how did this happen with these songs from Fiddler on the Roof?
Oh, I think there's a lot of strains to that answer. One is just the role of the Broadway musical in the mid-20th century, where that was really the pop music, before, you know, top 40 on the radio started to supersede the place where people looked for popular music.
So when we say the Great American Songbook, many of those songs came from Broadway.
Absolutely right. So there's that, and there are other reasons too.
Well, that's why the book is so big. Wonder of Wonders, A Cultural History of Fiddler on the Roof. You kind of do your own version of train spotting, where you keep track of Fiddler on the Roof references as they appear in pop culture. Give us some examples.
I think one of my favorites on The Simpsons, Homer is trying to borrow some money from a rabbi and trying to pretend he's Jewish. And so the way he pretends he's Jewish is he says, well, I've rented the movie Fiddler on the Roof and I plan to watch it.
So it's been on The Simpsons and Mad Men and Community. And just recently, on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me,
yes,
it sort of reared its shaggy head. Listen to this.
Mo, group of Brooklyn drug dealers texted their customers that they should make their purchases early on Friday because the dealers were going to go do what?
The dealers were going to go to temple?
To celebrate.
The Sabbath.
Yeah, yeah. Shabbat, as the Jews
Shabbat,
say,
yeah.
Yes. They were closed. The drug dealers were closing early for Shabbat.
Okay.
Wonders of wonders, miracles. Of wonders.
Dealer on the roof.
Yeah.
Is this the little girl I sold to?
That is Soundcheck regular Faith Saley coming up with a good one at the end there. So they're kind of riffing just on the spur of the moment.
Yeah, and it just goes to show how much at the surface this show is in popular consciousness, even 50 years after it opened on Broadway.
And of course, as you point out in the book, there's like another 50 years before that, even more, almost 60 years before that. So the story has a long kind of history. There's a big gestation period for the musical and then the film. But for folks who maybe haven't seen either the musical or the movie, give us a thumbnail description of the story of Fiddler on the Roof.
It's the story of Tevye the milkman and his three marriageable daughters who are living in the Pale of Settlement in around 1905. And
the Pale of Settlement being that part of Eastern Europe that's now like Belarus, Ukraine.
Yeah, and the area that Jews were required to live in.
Right.
And each of his daughters chooses her own husband against the tradition of father's approval and an arranged marriage. And each one sort of moves farther and farther from the expectation.
Mm-hmm. So it's really a story about, as one song says, tradition versus, you know, changing times, modernity.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the changes come both from inside as the girls in the family try to take their own paths, as well as from the outside, from the pogroms that are visited upon the community.
Mm-hmm. And all of these stories, and there are multiple stories about Tevye and his family and his trials and times and all that, comes from a great Yiddish writer of the turn of the last century.
Yeah, the greatest in many estimations. That's Sholem Aleichem.
Mm-hmm.
And the stories were written over about a 20-year period. The first Tevye story, I think, was in 1894. And they develop and become darker, actually, over time. And the authors of Fiddler on the Roof left out some of the darkest stories.
Yeah. But now, at the time when they started planning to do the Broadway musical, I mean, Jewish writers, directors, producers, actors, you know, they were commonplace on Broadway, but to actually have something so clearly Jewish-themed, was that kind of a revolutionary thing to do?
Very revolutionary thing to do. There, of course, Broadway was a Jewish art form. It was made almost entirely by Jewish composers and directors and book writers and so on, with some significant exceptions. But to represent the Yiddish background of American Jews was something that just hadn't been done before. People were moving away from that history. They were blending in as Americans. They were assimilating. It was the post-war period of exuberance and prosperity, and there was more tolerance for Jews than there ever had been, and they could be full Americans. And so in a way that allowed them, I think, to embrace this representation, because there was a level of security that they hadn't had before.
But you know, you write at one point in the book that finding a producer for this was like a real challenge.
A real challenge. They kept running into producers who were saying they thought it was too Jewish. One of the stories is that one of them said, well, what are we going to do for an audience when we run out of Hadassah groups?
So you've got Jerry Bock doing the music. You've got Sheldon Harnick doing the lyrics. They had a success with Fiorello.
Fiorello, that's right.
The book by Joseph Stein and the choreography, of course, by Jerome Robbins, hugely successful with West Side Story and Gypsy. So they put this show together, and they put it on Broadway, and what happens?
It breaks every record anybody ever thought of. Box office record. It runs for nearly 8 years. It's just an enormous hit.
The musical of Fiddler on the Roof. Here's an excerpt from the original cast recording.
Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Find me a find, catch me a catch. Matchmaker, matchmaker, look through your book and make me a perfect match. Matchmaker, matchmaker, I'll bring the veil. You bring the groom, slender and pale. Bring me a ring, for I'm longing to be the envy of all I see. For Papa, make him a scholar. For Mama, make him rich as a king. For me, well, I wouldn't holler if he were as handsome as anything. Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Find me a find, catch
from the original cast recording of Fiddler on the Roof, the Broadway musical that opened in 1964. That's Matchmaker, Matchmaker. We're speaking with Elisa Solomon, professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism and author of the new book, Wonder of Wonders, A Cultural History of Fiddler on the Roof. Although we don't hear him in that clip, the figure of Zero Mostel looms large in a couple of senses of the word.
Yes, enormously.
So what was his role other than being Tevye? I mean, in the sort of the cultural phenomenon that this musical becomes.
He was a great star, first of all. I mean, he just had whatever that unnameable quality that great stage performers had, he just had tons of it. He was mesmerizing on stage, and he was fearless. The actors that I spoke to who were in the original production said that he would come into a rehearsal, he'd barely glance at the new lines as they were working, he would know them immediately. He apparently had a photographic memory. He would try something new every day, and it always worked. Mm. And he also had grown up in an Orthodox family, so he brought deep knowledge of Yiddishkeit, of Yiddish culture. He knew the language. He knew the religion. He had a really deep well of information and attachment, even though he had left the practice behind to become an artist.
And he had a way of conveying a wry grin, a sense of wit and humor, even when the lyrics might have been just about quotidian day-to-day things like wishing you were rich.
Right. And there's a famous moment in that song, two things about that song that Zero Mostel contributed to, according to Sheldon Harnick, who wrote the lyrics. One is that if you look at the score for the musical, he says, all day long I'd biddy biddy bum,
yes,
and syllables like that. And that's just what Sheldon Harnick wrote down to try to approximate these sounds that he and Jerry Bock had heard at a Hebrew Actors benefit, where mm-hmm. they'd heard this sort of Yiddish burbling, and he just put those placeholder syllables in there. But Zero Mostel knew exactly what that was, and if you listen to the original recording, he does not sing biddy biddy bum. He does this, I can't even do it. It's just this amazing, prayer-like, mumbly, mushy, beautiful, cantorial kind of sound.
If I were a rich man, all day long I'd biddy biddy bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a biddy biddy rich, idle diddle 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 man, I'd build a big tall house with rooms by the dozen right in the middle of the town. A fine tin roof with a real wooden floors below. There couldn't be one long staircase just going up and one even longer coming down. And one more leading nowhere just for show. I'd fill my yard with chicks and turkeys.
Well, as Tevye, Zero Mostel certainly, as I said before, looms large in our cultural conversation about Fiddler on the Roof. The film version is Topol.
That's right.
Who himself is a kind of larger-than-life figure. But neither of them represents the first time that Tevye, the character, strides across the American stage. And that was one of the things in your book that I was unaware of, that there had been a kind of Yiddish theater version of this before.
Yes, and a very important one. Sholem Aleichem was wrote great masterpieces of short stories, and he wanted to break into the Yiddish theater when he came to the U.S., and he really failed at that. It's a sad, sad story that he just can't make it in the theater. But he himself had written an adaptation of the Tevye stories for the stage and never saw them performed in his lifetime. But 3 years after he died, I think he died in 1916, in 1919, Maurice Schwartz, who was one of the great Yiddish actors ever, put the show on stage in the second season of his Yiddish Art Theater, just downtown here mm-hmm. in New York, and it was a tremendous hit. He was an actor of great gravitas and also some humor, And then he made a film version 20 years later in 1939. So you can actually see him playing this role. It's 1939. You know, everybody knows what's happening in Europe. So it's a very grim version. It's a very grim and sad version of the story.
So, and it's under the name Tevye der Milchiker.
Yeah.
Tevye the Milkman. He filmed it on Long Island,
yeah, that's
apparently.
Right.
So this is the 1939 movie that Maurice Schwartz made, a Yiddish language version of the story of Tevye. It's funny how they sort of slip between speech and song there.
Yeah, I think what's happening there, my Yiddish isn't great. I would need to listen to it a couple times a little slower.
Yeah, but, a lot slower.
But I think what's happening there is it's one of the many moments when the Tevye character quotes from scripture, as he's often doing, and he's often getting it wrong. But Maurice Schwartz is doing it in a way, in that the way that guys would study Talmud together, and they would kind of sing the phrase.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Elisa Solomon about her book Wonder of Wonders, A Cultural History of Fiddler on the Roof. How closely does the story of Fiddler on the Roof parallel the story of the great Jewish immigration to the United States in the 20th century?
A lot. And I think that's part of why it was so successful. And in some ways it differs from the original Shalom Aleichem stories in that respect. That is, even though it ends with the sense of exile, there's a kind of happy feeling, you know, all the same, because we know where this family is going. It's coming here to the United States, where the children and grandchildren of Tevye are sitting in the Broadway theater enjoying this show and enjoying the enjoying the fruits of life in a wealthy country.
Yeah.
Where they're not persecuted.
Soundcheck listeners, what do you think? What does Fiddler on the Roof mean to you? You can leave a comment on our website at soundcheck.org or give us a call. Our voicemail is 866-939-1612. It occurs to me, Elisa, that the writers and producers of Fiddler on the Roof were walking a fine line. They wanted to kind of reflect Jewish culture, but there's, you know, if you go a little too far, you get into stereotype and cliche. And, you know, how do you think they did with that?
I think they did okay. I think part of the reason was Zira Mostel knew how to walk that line. And so did the rest of the cast. One of the things that was really interesting and surprising to me as I was doing the research was to find the notes, the audition notes, that Jerry Robbins and his collaborators had made while they were looking at actors. And there are all these notes about not wanting actors who were flapping their hands too much or were stereotypical in the sort of vaudevillian or borscht belt tradition of Jewish performance. They wanted people to be Jewish from the inside out.
And is that why? Is that part of the reason why it is still something that people refer to, perhaps some now without even realizing they're referring back to Fiddler on the Roof?
Yeah, I mean, it became so iconically Jewish, and it came to have this sense of being a historical document. You know, not something that was the artificial invention of a bunch of genius showbiz professionals.
Mm-hmm. And what about, is it still embraced by the Jewish community today, both inside and outside the U.S.?
It is, and beyond the Jewish community too, but I think now with some postmodern irony. People still love it, but they sort of like to put quotation marks around it. I mean, it was last revived on Broadway in 2004, and though the reviews were mixed, it was the longest running of any of the revivals that have happened since the original production. I mean, people went to it for a couple of years, and the national tour did very well with audiences.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm wondering is, could the kind of phenomenal success of Fiddler on the Roof in the 60s be attributed to that place and time? You know, was there something happening in America in the 60s that made it the right time? Whereas now we do sort of look at it with a wry smile and a wink and a nod.
Yeah, well, I think there are things happening in both times. I mean, one, in the 60s, as I said, it was a time where Jews were enjoying a level of security that they hadn't felt before. And so now they could look back fondly on this history. And of course, it was post-Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a need to embrace the history of the culture that no longer existed, I think. But for us nowadays, there's another phenomenon that makes us, I think, embrace Fiddler or re-embrace Fiddler that we were reluctant to do maybe in the 80s or 90s, and that has to do with the explosion of Yiddish culture, with the Klezmatics and other bands like that in the late 80s and 90s. So in between, it was the Broadway shows like Fiddler were kind of the stand-in for Jewish music. Mm-hmm. And for people who came along and said, that's not really klezmer, now they don't need to reject Jerry Bach's score anymore on those grounds. Of course, it was never trying to be klezmer. But Right. Now that we have that back in our popular culture, we can let Fiddler on the Roof be some other kind of Jewish music.
It can even be Jewish music as American pop. I mean, you mentioned 2004 Revival. That was when Gwen Stefani did her song Rich Girl.
Yeah, that's right.
Kind of riffing on If I Were a Rich Man. We'll hear a little bit of that from Gwen Stefani, but first, Alisa Solomon, professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, is author of the new book, Wonder of Wonders, A Cultural History of Fiddler on the Roof, full of fascinating history and details about it. And Alisa, thanks for sharing just some of it with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. A few weeks back, we talked with the members of the Meat Puppets, a band that back in the 90s inspired Nirvana's Kurt Cobain and even played with Nirvana on their famous MTV Unplugged session. After that, the Meat Puppets broke up for about 10 years, and you can hear the full story when you listen to the band's interview at soundcheck.org. It does involve one of the band members being shot at by a security guard. Anywho, the Meat Puppets are back together, and Soundcheck co-sponsored a Meat Puppet show with Brooklyn Bowl for the CBGB Festival here in New York. This is actually one of the songs that Nirvana covered in that Unplugged session 20 years ago. It's the Meat Puppets with Plateau.
Thanks a lot. We'll be right back.
That's the Meat Puppets with Plateau, one of their older songs, performed live in a Soundcheck and Brooklyn Bowl co-sponsored concert for the CBGB Festival this month here in New York. We'll hear another song from the Meat Puppets next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Here's another song from the band The Meat Puppets, taken from their recent show at the Brooklyn Bowl, co-sponsored by Soundcheck and part of the annual CBGB Festival. This is a live version of the title track of their early album, Up on the Sun.
Thank you.
That's the Meat Puppets with the title track from their album Up on the Sun. Their latest album is called Rat Farm. It is out now. That was recorded live at Brooklyn Bowl, a CBGB festival concert co-sponsored by Soundcheck. Tomorrow on the program, Moby. Just Moby and his friends. They'll be here for the whole show. They'll play a few songs from his new album, Innocence, as well as some of his older hits. Plus, Moby will give us a pick three of songs he discovered via public radio while in high school. So that's Moby in a special extended in-studio session tomorrow on Soundcheck. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop and Mike Katziff with Isaac Davey Aronson and Amy Pearl, and our intern Alex Martinez. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer, and this is Soundcheck.